Okay, so before I start on the talk, maybe I'll tell you what are the other topics I'm interested in. So I'm mainly interested in solid state systems, and cold atoms is sort of a recent interest. But I'll talk about the cold atoms work given the topic of the workshop. But things that I'm currently thinking about, which I'd be very happy to talk to people. Unfortunately, I'm leaving tomorrow, so I've been thinking about thermally fluctuating superconductors, things like Nernst effect and magnetization. All the work has been done by Daniel, who's here and who's going to be around for some more time. So you should really, if you're interested in this, talk to him. And Sri Raghu is a postdoc at Stanford. So two other topics that I'm currently thinking about. One is about this very interesting material called manganese silicide-related materials like uranium, germanium, and so on, which are all helimagnets, which have itinerant electrons. But it turns out that the electronic physics is non-Fermi liquid in terms of transport, and we have come up with some ways of thinking about this in terms of fluctuating magnetism. It's sort of speculative, but I'd be very happy to talk to people about this. And a lot of my interest these days is in frustrated magnetism. So one particular topic I've been working on recently is situations where you actually have collinear magnetism on triangular and Kagame magnets. There's experimental examples, and there's some theoretical issues there that are interesting. Okay, so, but for today, let me talk about spinner condensates. So essentially, I'll be talking about bosonic atoms with spin and what new physics one could see over there. So experimentally, this is an area that's quite old, at least relative to cold atom physics. A lot of early experiments were done on spinner condensates just after the first BECs were made. And recently, there's sort of been an experimental revival. People have been looking at various issues in spinner condensates. Okay, so there are basically two topics. One is about an order by disorder phenomenon in spin to condensates, which we think is a very good candidate for seeing this order by disorder effect. And this is work done with Ari Turner, who's a grad student of Eugene Demler's, and Ryan, who's here right now. And this was recently published. There's also the second part of this talk, which I'm not sure I'll get to, but hopefully I can tell you a little bit about also new transitions that you might expect in these spinner condensates and two-dimensional spinner condensates where you have a modification of the usual KT physics, and this is in preparation with Daniel and also with Shailesh Chandrasekharan, whose training is actually in lattice QCD, but somehow on this project our interests intersected. Okay, so basically what I'm thinking about is taking atoms with spin, bosonic atoms, in a situation where the spin degree of freedom is actually released. Okay, so for example, in an optical trap, the spin degree of freedom is present. And there are several examples of such atoms. So example spin 1, you have rubidium and sodium. And a lot of experiments have been, both of these have been condensed in optical traps. There have been a lot of experiments, very recent experiments on rubidium 87 looking at dynamics. So also spin 2, there are various examples. You can either have spin 2 in the ground state of an atom. So example, rubidium 85, or these could be excited states, which nevertheless people can trap and condense. So example, rubidium 87 spin 2 state has been trapped and condensed, and there are experiments on that. There's also been recent interest in spin 3, chromium condensates, and there's cesium was also condensed quite a while back. It's also spin 3. Okay, so clearly there are many examples of this, and what I think are the interesting physics issues over here, the fact that when you have these sort of condensates or bosons, you inevitably have both superfluidity and magnetism coexisting, and these two orders are sort of related in a quite a non-trivial way in these condensates, also given that these are higher spin, spin 2, spin 3, and so on, the kinds of magnetic orders that you can get are actually quite complex. And of course, once you have new orders, it also means that you can get new transitions. Okay, and experimentally, there's been a lot of focus on dynamics. These are systems where you can study very cleanly the dynamics of these systems. Okay, so we already heard a little bit about the formalism for these cold atom systems yesterday in David's talk. So let me very quickly remind you what how people think about these atomic systems at the very low temperatures and low densities that they are studied in. Okay, so if you have some, let's just start with the scalar condensate. There's some operator that creates a boson. And there's some interaction between bosons, which really speaking, if you look at the molecular physics, is some Lennard-Jones sort of interaction potential. But this length scale is very small. It's some atomic length scale order of an angstrom. So when you're in this very cold and dilute regime, you can really absorb all of the effects of this interaction effectively into a scattering length. And because these atoms are so cold and dilute, they essentially only interact via the S-wave scattering length. And you can write on sort of an effective Hamiltonian where you have the scattering length and some sort of contact interaction. And as usual, you understand this contact interaction as being something that is really regularized at very short molecular scales. But for most practical purposes, you can simply think of this as some contact interaction. And there's a small parameter in this problem, of course. That's the diluteness of this system relative to the scattering length, so this Na cubed is the small parameter. And because you have the small parameter, you can actually solve quite accurately for the ground state. So the first approximation to the ground state is from mean field theory. It's simply a coherent superposition of, it's simply a coherent state of this of these bosons so that they get an expectation value. The boson destruction operator has some expectation value, and that's really the condensate wave function. Okay, so it's so that's the case with the scalar condensates. And it's quite easy to generalize this to atoms with some non-trivial spin. Okay, so once you have some spin S, I'll just consider integer spins, and these spins are of course a combination of the electronic spin and the nuclear spin. Okay, so except for the case of chromium, the spin is the total spin of the atom. Okay, so. Okay, so once you have spin S, there are there's not just one, but several scattering channels. So the particles that are colliding off one another can be in different relative spin states. The thing you need to ensure is that you have a completely symmetric spin wave function, because you're guaranteed by this by the conditions of this of these experiments that the relative wave function of the orbital wave function is always S wave. So you're forced to have symmetric spin wave functions, and that essentially implies that the total spin of your pair of atoms can be anything between 0 and 2s. Okay, so there are s plus 1 relative spin states for these for this pair of atoms, and in general, the scattering lengths in these different spin states are going to be different. Okay, and that's really what gives you the interaction between spins. Okay, so. Depending on what scattering lengths you get over here, you can get different magnetic structures. Okay, so we'll for most of this talk, we'll really think about simple condensates, where we really think about condensing the boson operator, the single boson operator. And in that case, you get some condensate wave function. So of course, this won't have any spatial structure. We'll assume that's in the continuum. You're condensing into zero wave vector, but it does have some spin structure. Okay, and the question is, what are the different spin structures it can have, and what interactions stabilize these different spin structures? Okay, so the first question is, how do you represent a certain spin structure? We know for spin a half, it's very simple. If you have any spin a half particle, it's simply pointing in some direction. So if you like, there's a spinner U and V, but essentially the spinner implies a certain direction. And probably the simplest way of representing spin a half is these are these Schwinger bosons. Okay, so introduce some. Okay, so you have these two bosonic operators, and the sum of their numbers is constrained by the length of the spin. So if spin a half is just one boson, and the most general wave function you can write down is simply a linear combination of creating a particle in the up boson and creating one in the down boson. Okay, so all of these states necessarily point along some direction, but for a higher spin, for example, spin 1, spin 2, and so on, this is more complicated. Okay, you can't really think of the spin as pointing along any particular direction, but you can still use the Schwinger boson representation. So that's what Ryan and collaborators pointed out in this context. To really visualize the states of these higher spin condensates, it's really useful to think in terms of the Schwinger boson representation. Okay, so let's do spin 1, for example. For spin 1, there are we need to have two bosons, so there are two different spinner wave functions you can write down, and these essentially correspond to two points in the sphere. Okay, so any spin 1 wave function you can essentially think of as two points on the sphere, and these two points are identical because these are identical bosons. Okay, now this becomes extremely useful.
Sorry. Yeah. S goes to S plus 1 points. Do you mean S? You had two S bosons, so is that a typo? When you spin 2, do you put it? You got four Schwinger bosons, so it seems like you should have four points. Or is there something?
Yeah, that's spin 2 is 4. That's right. It's 2s.
So that's
So these two points on the sphere, should I think of them as two points on a block sphere representing two spin halves?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But in that case, if I just think about all the states represented by these two points on the sphere, that includes also the spin 0 space. So that somehow is.
Yeah, it's a symmetric. So these are identical particles. So there's really no meaning to this 1 and 2. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so that gets rid of the
spin 0. Yeah. Okay, so let me do the spin 1 in a little more detail. So actually, this is the case that's been studied the most, and it's the simplest case. Okay, so the case of spin 1, you have two possible scattering channels. There's the two spin 1s can either be in spin 0 or spin 2. And in general, you have these two different scattering lengths. But typically what happens is that the difference in these scattering lengths is quite small. Okay, it doesn't have to be the case always, but often, for example, for sodium 23 or rubidium 87, this may be a few percent of A0. Okay, but nevertheless, because you're talking about a condensate, even a very small energy difference has a big effect in terms of selecting the condensate. Okay, so for example, if you make a very simple-minded comparison of energy scales, that's not quite correct. This difference in scattering length might translate into an energy scale of, say, a nanokelvin, and your temperature may be 100 Kelvin or something like that. But nevertheless, it completely determines the magnetic structure of your ground state. Again, the reason, of course, is that we're talking about condensates. If you look at any energy difference, you've got to multiply that by the number of particles in your system. Everything's amplified by the number of particles in your system. And therefore, actually, any energy difference you speak of over here is really an energy per particle. Okay, so that's important to keep in mind. Although we're going to talk about small energy scales, we're talking about the effect on the condensate. Okay, so the best way of thinking in terms of spin 1 the most obvious thing you do is to write down three different Bose operators creating the spin 1 in m equal to 0 or plus or minus 1, right? Actually, it turns out it's a little bit more useful to use these p-wave orbitals, which are simply complex, which are related to these plus minus 1, 0 in the usual way. And instead, let me use this 3 vector to represent these spin 1 system. Okay, so now it turns out in terms of these bosonic operators, the spin operator is simply this cross product. Okay, so it's represented by a bilinear in these bosonic operators. And if you write down what this interaction Hamiltonian looks like in this second quantized language, there's one term that's completely insensitive to the spin of this of the relative spin of these particles. We're really thinking of some interaction Hamiltonian, two particles, four fields. This is like the sum of these two scattering lengths. It's not sensitive to the difference between them. But there's another term which actually depends on the spin configuration. Okay, so clearly this spin operator transforms like a vector under rotations. So do these operators over here. And I can write down an invariant that involves four of these Bose operators, which is just S dot S. Okay, so now this thing actually depends on the difference in scattering lengths. It's a constant times this A2. It's a positive constant times the difference in these scattering lengths. So you can see that if this this parameter over here is positive, you'd like a situation where there's no net spin in your ground state. Okay, so in terms of these the Schwinger boson representation of higher spins, you'd like these two points on the sphere to be in opposite, to be at antipodal points, so that the net spin is zero, and that's really just a uniaxial pneumatic. Okay, so you can represent the spin state of the system by direction, which is the direction along which you have these zeros. Okay, for the opposite sign of B, you want this to have maximum spin. So both of these points live at the same, both these spins are at the same point, and in that case, you'd get a ferromagnet. Okay? So it turns out that there are physical realizations of both of these that have been cut off. Sodium 23 is of this kind, and rubidium 87 is of that kind. Okay, so so that's how things work out for spin 1, and it's quite easy to generalize this for spin 2. So let me do that. Really, the point of this talk will be to understand in more detail the phase diagram of spin 2. Okay, and you'll see that the simple mean field energetics doesn't solve the problem for you. You have to go beyond mean field theory. Okay, but it's possible to do that and actually work out this phase diagram. Okay, so since this is mainly a theory audience, I'll actually go through some algebraic details. I'll try to see if it's getting really boring for people, and if it does, I'll sort of skip through some details. Okay, so this actually has been studied for a long time. So formally, this is the same as a D-wave superconductor in the continuum. Okay, so Merman had already looked at this problem 3 decades back, and it's been revisited in this cold atom context by Jason Ho's group and Sunkit Yip, and, I don't know if he's around, and also by Ryan and collaborators. Okay, so the interaction Hamiltonian over here has three different scattering lengths for the spin 2. They can be in relative spin 0, 2, or 4. And again, in this case, you have these five different spin 2 boson creation operators, which you can rewrite as in this D-wave basis, which is a more convenient representation of this spin 2. Okay, so this is some real vector that has, this is some vector that has five components. It's not real. These are all, operators which can take on complex expectation values. but this particular vector doesn't transform in a simple way under rotations. Okay, so in order to get something that transforms simply under rotations, under the rotational symmetry of this problem, so we'll assume that our system has full SO3 rotation symmetry. It also has this charge U1 symmetry. So the thing that transforms simply is to take these five operators and organize them into a symmetric tensor that has zero trace. So a traceless symmetric tensor has five components, and you organize them like this, and this actually transforms like a tensor under SO3. Okay, so it's very easy once you write it down in this form to figure out what the invariants of the system are. people who are familiar with pneumatics will recognize that this is the usual order parameter for a pneumatic, a symmetric tensor, but the one difference over here is that this is not necessarily real. Okay, it could be complex in the condensate. Okay, so so what are the so a better way of rewriting that interaction Hamiltonian in the second quantized language is as follows. First, define the spin operator. It's again bilinear in these fields, these boson creation operator fields, and the relevant matrix that you use is actually just the antisymmetric matrix. Okay, so that's one operator that's going to be useful. And when we write out this interaction Hamiltonian, there are three terms. There were three pairs.
Chi is the same as psi.
Yeah, it's just psi organized into a 3x3 matrix. Yeah. So this transforms as a tensor R chi R transpose. Okay, so this is guaranteed to transform like the spin as a vector under that thing. So there are three terms. There's one term that's completely insensitive to the spin physics, the sky dagger chi squared. But then there's another term which is sort of like our spin one term, s dot s term with some coupling constant. And finally, there's a third term which is sort of unique to spin two. So this is again a term that's invariant under rotations and phase the phase rotations of charge conservation symmetry, both of these coefficients depend on the differences in scattering length between the in the different spin channels. Okay, so clearly what we'd like to do now is to write a phase diagram in terms of these coupling constants. Yeah, that's right. So so imagine that this, so for a moment, imagine actually that this coefficient over here is negative, right? In that case, you'd like to maximize this operator over here. So you'd like to maximize less than zero and large negative, let's say, right? Okay, so then you want you can do this. So actually one way of writing this is in terms of these vectors that I wrote before. Right, so if you want to maximize this thing over here, you're best off if this psi is just e to the I phi times some real vector. Okay, so the fact that this is real is a signature that it's actually time reversal symmetric. Okay, so we'll see that when you have these chi's, or for that matter, these psi's, to be intrinsically complex, in the sense that you can't pull out a, this, it could of course be a complex.
So you could get chi squared trace to be negative.
That's right.
You want it to be zero, right?
Yeah, you'd want this to be zero without.
It's real, but you can make it zero, and the only way to make it zero and have a condensate is to.
That's right, just to make it complex, yeah, in some intrinsic way, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so so we can kind of guess what the phase diagram is going to be just from these. This one likes to, if GY is large, you want spin. If this guy is large and positive, you want to break time reversal symmetry. Okay, so that's what this phase diagram looks like, this GX and GY, which can be related to the scattering lengths like that. If you make GY very large and positive, you want to break, you want to get a net magnetization, you get this ferromagnetic state. So that exists everywhere here in the phase diagram. So this line is the GX equals GY line. So if you make it large and positive, which means going away that way, you want to break time reversal symmetry. The ferromagnetic state, of course, breaks time reversal symmetry. But there's also a state over here that's able to break time reversal symmetry but not generate a net magnetization. Okay, so it's when you frustrate it with GY negative but this other combination large and positive, you get the state. It's called the cyclic state. And a big advantage of this way of representing higher spin states in terms of these Schwinger bosons is you can just look at the state and say whether it has a net magnetization or not, whether it breaks time reversal or not. Okay, so the cyclic state has got these four points on the vertices of this tetrahedron, clearly breaks time reversal. Time reversal corresponds to taking each point to its antipodal point, but it has no net magnetization. And clearly it has many discrete symmetries, just the symmetries of the tetrahedron, and that turns out to be important in understanding the defect structure in this cyclic state. Okay, but finally, which is what's going to be the main focus of this talk, there's this pneumatic state where you neither have a net spin nor do you break time reversal symmetry, and you've got to arrange four points on the sphere so that you have time reversal symmetry, so you need the antipodal points occupied, and you also want no net spin, so that essentially forces you to have a rectangle, in general a rectangle. Yeah, that gives you a rectangle, right? It's, yeah. Well, it's, yeah. So the rectangle has got the origin in the plane of the rectangle. That's this nematic state. Okay, but you know, the cyclic state is actually very interesting. Let me say a few more words about it. So this is a state that if you in a particular basis where this tetrahedron is nicely oriented with respect to your coordinate axis, it has a complex chi, and it can be it can nevertheless be diagonalized, and it has these eigenvalues where omega is the cube root of unity. Presumably that's where the name comes from. So Ryan and company have a different name, tetrahedratic, which may be more descriptive for the state. Okay, and one interesting thing about it is it actually has non-abelian vortex excitations, point defects in two dimensions, line defects in three dimensions that have a non-abelian homotopy group. In fact, this first homotopy group is the symmetries of a tetrahedron that are doubled. Okay, so experimentally, where do we stand? So, you know, people claim to know the scattering lengths for these various spin 2 atoms, and they kind of cluster around this line for some reason I don't understand. So rubidium 85 is apparently in the cyclic state, but both rubidium 87 and sodium 23, you can make both spin 1 and spin 2. This is a spin 2 version of those excited state. Apparently they live close to the boundary, but perhaps on the nematic side. I think they don't really have the resolution to say if it's on this side or that side, but they're all near that boundary. A little bit unfortunate thing about this rubidium 85, it has negative scattering lengths, so it's not very stable. People can do some experiments on it, but and perhaps there are other atoms that people have not talked about. But this is what the experimental situation looks like. So clearly, experimentally, the most interesting things to look at is the cyclic and this nematic state.
Rubidium 85, can you take it through a fresh path resonance or something and get the scattering length to be positive? But then would that change these other parameters as well?
Zeeman term, which
is that's right. Yeah. So you lose the
behavior in zero magnetic field.
That's right. You need rotational symmetry for a lot of these interesting properties.
Although the non-polarized ones presumably survive to turning on the magnetic field.
Okay, so the way magnetic field acts on this thing, I'll get to that. It's not that obvious as Zeeman field. It's actually a quadratic effect. But it does introduce an axis, so you break the rotational symmetry. It's very weak on the cyclic state because you put on a vector on a tetrahedron, it doesn't know which way to orient. But you know, higher order terms perhaps will. Okay, so it's not obvious, but Okay, so let's focus on this nematic state. There are two reasons. One is experimentally it looks like it may be relevant. Second reason is it turns out there's something. There's an accidental symmetry over here, accidental degeneracy over here that the mean field theory is not able to resolve, and presumably fluctuation effects can resolve. Okay, so let's study a little bit more the energetics of this nematic state. So it turns out there's a high symmetry line in this problem, which is when you set this gy to zero. Okay, so along that line, the system actually has an enhanced symmetry, which is actually SO5 symmetry. So as I said before, you can write this the third term as the dot product of these two vectors, mod squared, that's been cut off by the projector. And there's this term over here. So any rotation of this phi vector is a symmetry of the system. There's a SO5 symmetry. Okay, so let's solve the problem along this line. So when you have this, when you're on the nematic side of this line that is having this negative, you want to maximize this product over here. So you want psi being some phase times a real vector. Okay, in other words, your matrix, as I just explained over here, is actually a real traceless symmetric matrix. In other words, it's a nematic state. Okay, so naturally, because it's real, it has no spin, and it preserves time reversal symmetric. Okay, but there are many different nematic states that have exactly this representation, depending on the eigenvalues of this traceless symmetric matrix, if you like. Or better still, in terms of the spin representation, there are many ways to arrange zero spin so that it it also has time reversal symmetry. One extreme is this uniaxial nematic, where pairs of points are at antipodal locations. Another, but the most generic situation is when you have this rectangle, right, for these four points. Okay, and
ways just meaning just there's two different eigenvalues.
That's right. Yeah. 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 So there's one situation over here which is not realized in regular nematics. I'll get to that you have a square, there's some enhanced symmetry, kind of biaxial pneumatic. This is biaxial, yeah. A general rectangle is biaxial, but there's an enhanced symmetry biaxial pneumatic, which is not the same as uniaxial in this case. But just, yeah, just one more slide. So at this level, even if you put back this GY term, because at mean field level, there's no spin in this condensate, this term is not effective in selecting between these different states. Okay, so if you take this Hamiltonian over here, do mean field theory, all of these different pneumatic states exactly degenerate. Okay, but actually some of this degeneracy is accidental, and clearly if you look at quantum fluctuations or thermal fluctuations, they won't survive. Okay, and this sort of selection is goes under the name of order by disorder. So there are many people who have written papers on this order by disorder, including myself, in context of magnetism. But actually, I think there's no good example of an order by disorder of a physical system, experimental system, where this order by disorder has clearly been shown to be the reason for the ordering of the system. Okay, and the reason is actually it's sort of a subtle effect. you need to make sure that the kind of order that you get at the end of the day is really because of fluctuations and not because of some other coupling that you didn't know about. Okay, in some solid state system, you hardly know, you don't really know the Hamiltonian that well.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
In terms of the effective mid-field description, probably it will be all the same. You will be adding some extra terms to your...
That's right, but it'll be a higher order term. So
give an example of this higher order terms. In terms of density, higher order in terms of density.
That's right, three body terms. So in this case, we know that three-body interactions are small because of the low density of the system. Okay, that's something you have to compare at the end of the day, that the kind of splitting you get over here is much larger than what you'd get just by collisions of three particles, right? But essentially, you can think of fluctuations, if you like, generating a sixth-order term in the fields. In fact, I'll show you what that term is at the end of the day. but the coefficient of that term can actually be calculated by if the fluctuations are weak. Okay, so you really need, yeah.
It's just irrelevant terms, critical point, but they're irrelevant in the phase. Is that how I should think?
No, that's probably true, but I'd really think of it simply as some higher order term over here that physically you don't have because it's some dilute gas, or you have with a very small amplitude, but fluctuations can generate some effective interaction that has
a...
Symmetry doesn't forbid them, but at this level it's a symmetry because you've truncated your Hamiltonian up to some.
And so they're probably not important for critical properties or something.
Yeah, it's some sixth order term.
But then in the phase.
Now you're talking about the entire pneumatic phase or just this special SFI?
No, the entire pneumatic phase.
It's true with the entire.
Yeah,
phase.
So the discussion was motivated, this point.
What role does the SFI just motivates it, but once you.
That's right. And the reason is that, if you look at average spin in these pneumatic states is zero. Right? So average of this in a condensate, I can take there. That's right. You only maximize this, and we've already done that. So it's still this SO5.
Already the entire phase.
That's right, yeah, in mean field theory. Okay, so, this is really a good setting for studying order by disorder because we have some, you really need a weak effect, right? If the fluctuations are very strong, you're not sure you can start with mean field theory and add fluctuations. So here the fluctuations are weak because it's, there's a small parameter, and we know the Hamiltonian, so it's a good setting to see if this, you can realize this order by disorder effect. Okay, so before I actually go to that, the fluctuations, let me say a little bit more about these pneumatic states and why it's a little bit different in the case of the condensate. Okay, so if you have some general pneumatic state or some general 3x3 matrix that you know is a real symmetric matrix times perhaps some complex number, you can always find some basis by doing SO3 rotations. You can find some basis where... the matrix is diagonal, and the tracelessness is implemented by this way of writing the eigenvalues. Okay, you can essentially parameterize these matrices in terms of some one parameter eta, and this is set up in such a way that the matrix is traceless. Okay, so what does this eta mean? So if you can sort of look at some representative cases, say eta equal to zero, this is the matrix that you get. Two of the eigenvalues are equal, and there's a third one that's different. And this really corresponds to the uniaxial pneumatic. Okay, this is an axis, the z-axis, along which this pneumatic is pointing. and that's the special axis. Okay, now it turns out there's another special case when eta is equal to pi over 2, and in this case it turns out that all three eigenvalues are different, but you know, one is the negative of the other. Okay, so you know, in this particular case, the corresponding spin configuration looks like this. It's a rectangle, but it's a special rectangle. It's got equal, you know, it's a square essentially, and it's a square in the xy plane. Okay. So as a function of eta, if you look at how this thing evolves, it goes from being a uniaxial pneumatic to a square pneumatic at this value, then rotates into the y direction and so on. So essentially adding pi by 3 to this eta is rotating by 90 degrees along these coordinate axes. And at these special points, it's either square or uniaxial pneumatic. And the general pneumatic, of course, for general eta is a biaxial pneumatic. It's a it's a rectangle. And actually, people have been looking for this kind of phase for a long time in liquid crystals. I think it's been found not very long ago. But the reason people give for why it's hard to realize this in liquid crystals, essentially, if the order is weak and I can do a sort of Landau expansion, there's a term in the free energy that's cubic in this order parameter. Okay, and in terms of eta, that means there's a cosine 3 eta. And irrespective of the sign of the coupling, you end up with a uniaxial state that minimizes this free energy. Okay, and at least there's sort of a Landau justification for why it's hard to get biaxial pneumatics in liquid crystals. Now, the reason you don't suffer from this problem over here is because you're not allowed to write a chi-cube term. Okay, so the order parameter over here contains charge. You have to respect the charge symmetry. Therefore, no term that's odd in chi is allowed. Okay, and it's also the term that tells you the transition to the pneumatic state is first order. It's forbidden over here. So the transition into this polar state doesn't have to be first order. Okay, so that's what you get from this mean field theory, and now you'd like to expand around that mean field solution. So let's say that was your mean field state parameterized by eta, one of these represented by axial states. And what I'd like to know now is what do fluctuations do? Okay, so you make some small expansion, and you can expand the Hamiltonian to quadratic order, and as usual, you solve for the normal modes. And if you now want to evaluate the ground state energy, you simply look at the zero-point energies of all of these normal modes. I think there should be a half over here. Right? So each harmonic oscillator, so quadratic Hamiltonian is just a bunch of harmonic oscillators, each one of them has a zero-point energy. And this zero-point energy over here will actually depend on precisely which state you're expanding the fluctuations about, and that can give rise to some quantum fluctuation of pneumatic order. And
You're adding just standard gradient term, right? Because before you were just discussing uniform.
Yeah, so I wasn't writing the full Hamiltonian.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just free particles, essentially. There's a free Hamiltonian, which is some... And then there's H interaction, which I was writing down. Yeah, so this is what gives you the dispersion. That's why I have this K. Just Bogoliubov theory with more modes. Okay, and the superfluid phonons that you had have some velocity. The velocity actually depends on which particular biaxial state that you have. So typically what you'd like is a low velocity superfluid phonon so that you have smaller zero-point energies. Okay, there's a very similar effect that you get from thermal fluctuations. The smaller the velocity of your superfluid phonons, the more excitations you can make at any given temperature, the more entropy you get. So there's a selection that way as well. Okay, so it turns out there's a very nice way of you know, expanding these fluctuations where the problem becomes very simple. So what one realizes is that you know, there's a special basis where of modes, so these off-diagonal modes, which correspond to rotations of the general biaxial pneumatic. So if I take a particular biaxial pneumatic represented by this diagonal matrix, parameterized by eta, make a small deformation along the off-diagonal elements, it's some rotation of that state. Okay, so those are some three modes. And in addition, of course, you have the mode that changes the phase of the condensate, the phase mode, and that corresponds to this collection of operators. And finally, there's a fifth mode. You've got to have five modes at the end. The fifth mode just corresponds to this accidental degeneracy, okay, rotating between different things that happen to be degenerate in this limit. kind of...
Are chi's bilinear in these Schwinger bosons, right? Or even
four? But let's not think in terms of... The Schwinger boson is mainly for just pictorial value, yeah.
I guess I want to understand. How do I understand that these are bosons, I guess, these chi-2-3s?
Oh, they have bosonic commutation relations between chi dagger and chi. They just commute with the usual, you know, minus I.
Because in the end, because original size, they came from original size, I guess, right?
That's right. They just size some linear combinations of size. That's right.
So in the uniaxial case, you lose one of the rotations.
That's right, yeah. So one of the rotational modes actually...
Or is it just that it gets soft, or what? You'll talk about that?
Actually, I wasn't planning to, but I can tell you what happens. So it becomes also one of these accidental degeneracy modes, right? So how are you?
Oh, there's still five modes. It's just...
That's a massive mode. That's
yeah. So, okay. You know, I won't actually
you
produce...
You have two accidental degeneracy
that's
modes.
That's right, yeah. Because you can distort it like... Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the utility of these modes is that if you write down this quadratic Hamiltonian, it's basically the Bogoliubov Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian just decouples into independent pieces. Okay, it's quadratic in each of these modes, and it simply decouples. And each one of these has the usual Bogoliubov form. There's the dispersion coming from this del squared term. So that's k. K is the momentum, and h bar k is the momentum in my representation, plus some... parameter over here that depends on which mode you're talking about. And then, of course, there are these pair creation terms with the same coefficient, right? Usual Bogoliubov theory. And now you can solve for the Bogoliubov spectrum. And as usual, you get this sort of spectrum where epsilon k is just this quadratic dispersion. And if you were to make a long wavelength approximation, you get sound modes, essentially. But the speed of sound is different for each one of these modes in general. And the speed of sound generally depends on which pneumatic state you started with. Okay. So let's just represent the solution of this problem simply in terms of what these different sound speeds are. So the first thing you look at is the phase mode. That's really the superfluid mode that gives rise to this, the sound in the superfluid. And the velocity of sound in that case is... simply related to the usual compressibility, as you'd expect. You can also look at the accidental degeneracy mode. I'm considering the case of some general biaxial state where I don't have to worry about this extra accidental degeneracy of the uniaxial state. So you get some other sound velocity. And at this level, of course, even this accidental degeneracy mode is gapless. Okay, if you go to higher, a more careful treatment, it will eventually acquire a gap. But at this level, it's gapless. But the nice thing is that it's independent of eta. Okay, it's independent of which particular pneumatic state I'm looking at. So if I want to look at the energy splittings between different pneumatic states, this doesn't corrupt that energy splitting. Maybe that's expected, but it's simply independent of eta, this velocity. Okay, so the things that really depend on eta are these rotation mode velocities, and they depend on eta in the following way. Depending on which rotation mode you're looking at, it has this... particular form where it depends on the cosine of this 2 times eta. Okay, so indeed you produce a difference between the sound velocities of these different modes that know about which pneumatic state you're sitting in. Okay, and there's actually a symmetry of this problem. it's related to the earlier SO5 symmetry that I spoke of. If you change the coupling constant gy, so reflect about this high symmetry line, and also shift eta by pi by 2, that's a symmetry. Okay, that doesn't change this term. At this level of approximation, this is the only thing that knows about eta. Okay, so the phase diagram is actually, if you know half of the phase diagram for these pneumatic states, you can get the other half simply by shifting this, the value of eta by pi by 2. Okay, so this shift actually takes you from the uniaxial state to the square pneumatic state. Those are the two high symmetry sort of configurations.
Gy equals 0 there.
That's right, yeah. That kind of makes sense because it's
still there.
Yeah, it's an. That's right. Okay, so here are the answers. So, one very nice thing about this problem is that you can solve for this, the fluctuation effect analytically. Okay, so if you look at the ground state energy, it's the sum of these zero points of these sound modes minus some constant. So as written, this thing is actually divergent, but you can fix that divergence by the usual, by putting in a cutoff as usual. But the nice thing is that the eta-dependent part is not divergent. Okay, the eta-dependent part is simply finite, and it simply involves these three the velocities of these rotation modes to the fifth power. Okay, so it.
What wavelength is dominant in there? Is it at the cutoff or is it at the?
Yeah, it's convergent. So.
Convergent, both infrared and ultraviolet.
And ultraviolet, yeah. For the.
So it's the modes at where it switches from linear to. There's a length scale in your spectrum where it switches from linear dispersion to quadratic dispersion.
That's right. That's, yeah, around that, yeah. Yeah, I think so. But But, yeah, I've got to go and check it. It's not apparent from this thing because you've got to take some derivatives to get that, right, to isolate the eta-dependent part.
You have to subtract the divergent piece.
That's right, yeah. So this is delta eta is this plus some infinite constant, you know, doing it naively, but you can use this cutoff and do it correctly, and you get a finite number for the whole energy. Okay, so it's a bit like these calculations of Casimir force, where the ground state energy is divergent, but the force is finite, and you can find the force up to all the coefficients and so on. Okay, so at finite temperature also you can do this, and now you can't do it analytically. It's this expression over here. But it turns out there's one limit which is pretty much always realized in experiments when the velocities, you know, this energy associated with the phonon velocity is much smaller than the temperature. You know, this is typically of order nanokelvin. Your temperature is at least 10 nanokelvin.
What's the difference between U and C?
I'm sorry, it's C. Yeah, mc squared. Yeah. Yeah, typo.
Typical one of these C.
That's right. There are many C's, but take the largest. So when your temperature is larger than this energy scale, which is almost always realized, you can simplify this a lot, and you can actually calculate analytically in that limit. And that limit, it turns out, this free energy splitting is actually proportional to temperature. Okay, and it goes as a lower power of this velocity, so it actually turns out this is a much bigger effect than the quantum effect. Okay, so one point over here is that because it goes linear in T, it means that all of this free energy splitting is entropic. There's no difference in the internal energy. And really, it's
Entropy. Different entropy. These states have different entropy.
That's right. It's not very easy to figure out the sign. Even at this stage of the calculation, knowing which state is lower in energy is not obvious, because the three.
So the sign, you know. Right?
Yeah, but physically, if I asked you which state is okay, so it's clear that it's either the uniaxial or the biaxial pneumatic that's going to be preferred, right? The square biaxial pneumatic is going to be preferred. But physically, can one guess which one's lower in energy in, you know, different parts of the phase diagram? Of course, I can just take this and, you know, see which one's lower. But, you know, if I told you what the velocities are, you know, the different velocities are, you know, different for these different states. And it's not simply a question of looking at the which one has the lowest velocity.
It's actually a difference. So this one's positive c to the fifth.
That's right.
Negative c to the q.
But they give you the same effect because this is, you know.
It ends up giving you the same effect.
Yeah.
Because the three velocities aren't independent.
That's right. Yeah, they're all. So actually, first when I got this, I thought I had the opposite. Thing. I mean, the quantum.
Make them do the opposite thing.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't make physical sense, right? Right. They actually do the same thing, which is. So both of these give you the same effect, and you can, you know, figure out the phase diagram. Okay, so you can sort of put in an extra line in the phase diagram, essentially, right? So as David pointed out, that this has to be a phase boundary, the high symmetry line over here. This is the area where you get the pneumatic state. And if you evaluate which one's the lowest state, you get a uniaxial pneumatic in the experimentally relevant part of the phase diagram and the square biaxial in the other part.
What is the regular biaxial? I got lost.
Square biaxial?
Non-square biaxial.
It skips it.
It just, yeah, it's not a high symmetry configuration, right? So
you can't stabilize it at this order.
Oh,
that's right, yeah.
There's only some higher order terms you could stabilize it, but it would probably be just a little tiny.
That's right, yeah. Maybe somewhere around here, the way it goes from one to the other, it's kind of natural.
All the pneumatics and the degenerate without these extra terms, I see.
That's right.
And so then the order by disorder picks up the symmetry.
Yeah, I mean, the lowest order calculation would typically do that, right? because
terms from sort of Landau.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Actually, here, it's here, yeah. Yeah, so if you think about this in terms of Landau theory, you essentially have a sixth order term that gives you cosine of 6 eta. Depending on the sine of this coefficient, you either get uniaxial or biaxial. So that sort of makes sense. And if you look at the free energy difference, now let's put in the parameters for this rubidium 87. So people have made condensates of rubidium 87 spin 2. There's a paper by Sengstock, that's Sengstock's group in Hamburg, that's quite nice. So of course, they were not trying to look for this order by disorder effect. They're just trying to show they could get a condensate and look at dynamics. So it's not particularly optimized for this, for searching for the state. But let's just take what values of density they have and so on. And the quantum splitting in this particular case is quite small. Actually, all of these splittings will be small. So per particle, it's about half a picokelvin. But the thermal effect is larger. So you can see that this is like sort of the full numerical solution of that thing. And this, one of the odd things about this order by disorder effect is that the order is actually more stable at higher temperatures. In fact, maybe I should have mentioned that before. So typically, you think of temperatures destabilizing order. In the case of this order by disorder effect, this, the free energy difference between the uniaxial and the square.
It's more stable. It's more energy.
Yeah.
Relative to temperature, it's not increasing. Right. What matters is delta E over.
It depends. I think the main competition over here is with the magnetic field. So imagine you have some.
It's more stable to a magnetic field.
That's right. Yeah.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah. And also just,
linear stability if it increases temperature.
Yeah, so for example, I'll show you that if I put on a magnetic field, I can switch between these states. So the magnetic field likes this kind of state.
If I have temperature, perhaps it's not a transition in the field.
Yeah,
correct?
Turns out there's a phase transition.
In the field, if I have
It's an icing phase transition.
Well,
do the experiments verify that it is indeed this uniaxial pneumatic?
No, the experiments are done at ambient, magnetic field, a third of a Gauss, right? Earth's magnetic field, which is huge for this. Actually, it's not that big. It's about 10 times larger than what we expect.
Always puts in a square pneumatic.
So they see a square pneumatic. Of course, that may not mean anything, right? This guy. So the magnetic field. Yeah, I'll come to that.
What are the features in the experiment? How do you recognize that you have a square pneumatic?
Okay, so I'll actually get to that next slide. But if you take a lighter atom like sodium 23, the quantum splittings are expected to be larger. It's smaller mass, right? More quantum fluctuations, and it's about 10 times larger. And perhaps this thermal effect can also be about a factor of 2 or so larger. Okay, but essentially we're talking about energy scales of around 10 picokelvin. And of course, this is much smaller than the two energy scales in the problem. That's the temperature and this the typical magnetic interaction energy scales. But nevertheless, because there's this degeneracy in a pure system where the condensate is really dictated by these could be dictated by these very small energy scales. I think by proper engineering, you can get it up by maybe a order of magnitude. That would be really great. But let's talk about experimental prospects. So the real competition, we think, maybe we have not looked at all possible factors, but the main competition we believe is the external magnetic field. In these cold atom systems, collisions preserve spin. Okay, so you look at any experiment, time scale of a second, the total spin of the system doesn't change even if you're in a magnetic field. Okay, so there's no linear effect. There is Lamot precession, but there's no contribution to the energetics from linear effect because all of these spin collisions conserve the total SZ. The field is along Z. Okay. So then the residual coupling that you have is really this quadratic Zeeman coupling. And for this particular case of rubidium 87, actually even for sodium 23, the sign of this coupling is known. It's actually an easy axis anisotropy. Okay, so this comes from how these energy levels split. The spin 2 and the spin 1 energy level split and mix, there's sort of some bending, which you can capture by this quadratic Zeeman effect. And what this thing ideally likes to do is to have a square biaxial pneumatic in the plane perpendicular to the magnetic field. Okay, so what does the square biaxial pneumatic perpendicular to this plane look like? Okay, so let me just, instead of using this vector representation, let me actually switch again to this.
Are you saying in the uniaxial state, I mean, SZ squared is also zero, but it's too small, smaller than the square?
Yeah, so square by actually populate the plus 2 and the minus 2.
That's why, okay, that's why you have that.
Yeah. So this is, that's the zero is populated if it's along the z-axis, just
zero. Zero is except the psi zero. Okay. All zeros except psi zero.
Yeah, and this is all zero except these two. So this is square biaxial in the xy plane.
One more zero.
No. Okay, so what they look for actually in this experiment is, so they can image these things separately, the thing, and they... So for one, I think they see that there's no zero component in the state along that direction, and they can see it's in this m equals plus minus 2. Okay, so...
Inside the particles out of the resonance?
That's right. It's resonant imaging, but spin-sensitive imaging. In our case, what we want is if we put on a field along the z direction, you're going from a situation where this is 1, right, to something that's like this. So essentially, the order parameter, so there's going to be a transition when you put on a field. The order parameter is the size of this component over here. So it's an Ising order parameter. There's also, yeah, that's right.
So there's no linear Zeeman because they put in an equal.
That's right.
Put in a total M sub z equals zero.
And that's not changed.
And that isn't changed, right? So your initial conditions determine that that's 1 and 1 as opposed to some other combination. You could have started off with total n.
Yeah, you could have put in a finite spin in the ground state, in the initial thing.
They don't.
Yeah, they don't. And yeah, I wonder what that would do. There's no linear effect, of course. Maybe, again, there's something like a quadratic. In these states, pneumatic state, there's no net magnetization. So the derivative of the free energy... You'd have some extra spins that are...
Phase separate or something.
Yeah.
The field is
long. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I'm not sure what happens when you have finite magnetization, but that's some question that you can ask.
Say,
they could do that, yeah.
But you're saying the material, the rubidium 87 is naturally, without magnetic field, without this quadratic Zeeman, gives you the uniaxial.
That's the claim, right?
Claim from scattering, like just from...
Oh, no, it's supposed to be in that part, it's supposed to be in the pneumatic part of the phase diagram. Right, but you know, at mean field level, you don't know what state it is. But this fluctuation effects, we believe, will give you a uniaxial pneumatic in that part of the phase.
They don't have a knob to shut off this and to check and to see the transit, to see the uniaxial state.
Shut off the field.
Well,
shut off
the milligauss. He says it here.
Yeah. So, so let's look at what happens in a magnetic field. Let me set at zero temperature. We believe this uniaxial state is stabilized. You switch on this magnetic field, and you end up in the square biaxial state. And there's a transition, and it's quite easy to see this transition is actually in the Ising universality class. It's the square has higher symmetry than... So what happens is that this uniaxial state, when you put on a field, drops into the plane and becomes sort of a rectangle, and then it becomes a square. Of course, the transition into a square is something discontinuous. It's a phase transition, and it has an Ising order parameter, depending on how you distort the square.
Okay, there's no susceptibility to magnetic field at all in one of the phases, right?
So yeah. So it's a... Because it's zero magnetization, right?
Again, about susceptibility. Magnetization field is zero, but...
Okay, uh-huh.
But it's DMDP.
No, it has a finite...
Saying as a practical matter, in the experiment, there's no susceptibility because it's a conserved quantity. It's not that the lowest energy state.
Yeah, it's not in equilibrium.
The system treated in equilibrium presumably has susceptibility, but the experiment isn't in equilibrium.
So again, what is kept constant in it? When you build theory, you keep constant M?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because there's no spin relaxation process.
That's right.
Or at least the spin relaxation process is...
Is longer than, one second or whatever.
Thermodynamics had fixed M. I didn't...
Yes, thermodynamics had fixed M, yeah.
That's
so
right.
M was really kept fixed in this one.
That's right, yeah. So then the only term in that subspace is this guy, right?
So how implemented, okay. So basically it's not equal to MH.
Yeah, so M is always fixed. So that's like an overall shift. So there are effects of magnetic field as Lamo precession, for example, but there's no Yeah, the thermodynamics isn't, maybe that's the right way of saying it. It's some sort of constrained ensemble.
It's a fixed magnetization ensemble.
Yeah, where you're not allowed to phase separate. And you could imagine doing fixed magnetization.
Phase separate. The system could phase separate. There's nothing preventing it from phase separating if it wanted to.
So I can consider various values of M, right? So for each.
Yeah, but this is sort of locally conserved also, right? In each collision.
No, only
because
locally.
The particles are moving.
It's just the total number of particles.
Yeah, but in any collision, your total spin is conserved, right? Yeah, that's what's keeping you in this fixed M ensemble.
Global M is fixed.
Because you can have, as a particle moves, it carries M, right? So there's no local conservation. There are M currents.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, if M is fixed, at which M is there this diagram?
Zero,
yeah.
And if I change M, my principle, if I can look at that diagram.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, that's what you have to do next.
The experiment found in an
that's one thing to do next. Actually, we tried a little bit, but, there's no, yeah, but,
and,
you know, my feeling is it gives you another term that's like M squared, right? If you look at the competition between these different states in a finite magnetic field, in a finite pole, magnetization ensemble.
It could just be paramagnetic.
I think if you have non-zero M,
yeah,
you change.
Exactly. So it's some quadratic in M. Correction. That looks a bit like this, right?
Oh, nothing to give you any physics.
Yeah, sorry.
If you can find a tab, you can different symmetry.
It'll just polarize the one non.
There's no
that one non.
Guarantee that the same thing.
Yeah. So, for example, you can have M dot B terms, right?
Right.
And you also have. There's no linear in M term. Clearly.
Well, if M is fixed, then you can put linear orbit. There's nothing, as long as M is global. But what I'm worried about is that. You may create, in principle, modulation of M, right? So keeping M constant, integral over dx, or dr, M is constant. But then you can make some M of R, which I guess is a space separation issue.
Yeah, it's sort of some.
Maybe this thing is unstable. Again, I'm just making things up. Maybe this thing is unstable with respect to modulation of M. And how does you know experiments that M is?
Oh, they dial that in, right? They have equal up and down populations to begin with.
They can control it.
See?
I mean, they can control it.
Yeah, they can control it.
Even at fixed M, you discover phase separate. You would discover if it wants to phase separate, if you work at fixed scale.
You can work at fixed total M, but integral of M of R dr is fixed. But
you'd see it as a phase separation. You would see. That's what happens in these polarized fermions mixtures.
Right.
These balanced fermion mixtures. If you work at fixed chemical potential and fixed M on average,
right.
Okay, you see, then you immediately see the phase.
So basically, you have to derive term which is gradient M and see whether the constant is positive or negative.
That's one way to do it. But another way to do it is just work at fixed chemical potentials and difference in chemical potential, so fixed Zeeman field,
but then
it's unstable. Phase separation.
The kinetic energy term is going to make a gradient of M
unfavorable,
which is positive. It's not going to
unfavorable at this stage, yeah. So unless there's some higher gradient terms that you generate, but they're unlikely to be large.
Kinetic energy wants to make things uniform.
Yeah, uniform, yeah. But that you can beat that. That surface tension versus.
But this is some
versus
you're
energy.
Some higher gradient term.
Yeah, with the wrong sign.
Yeah.
So this is what I was saying about temperature being stabilizing the state. The critical field you need increases with increasing temperature. Okay, in fact, it's thing. So, the typical field, or rather the best, so of course, if we go to very high temperatures close to the transition, then it drops back down very steeply. That's just how the mean field amplitude of this condensate drops to zero as you approach the transition temperature. So it's got this sort of reentrant behavior with temperature. And the field that we are talking about, this field over here, the case of the experimental parameters is around 10 times smaller than the Earth's magnetic field. Okay, so I think that's not an issue in terms of getting to those kind of fields. People routinely go down to 50 milligauss and so on. And experimentally, of course, they observe this square biaxial. So the signature of this phase transition is to look for this M equal to zero component and see it dropping to zero. That's the phase transition.
Actually, somehow my intuition is failing, because when I think of, in conventional liver crystals, uniaxial pneumatic to biaxial pneumatic, that's an XY-like transition. Because, you know, you have one axis, and now you're going to pick out another axis transverse to it.
But he has an imposed external
axis. Here there's a field, yeah. So as soon as you put on the field, this thing drops into the uniaxial guide drops into the plane.
One of the axes is...
Even when you're in the uniaxial pneumatic.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's a rotationally, it's, you know, symmetric state. Put on a field, it drops like that.
Okay, even while you stay in the uniaxial pneumatic. And then
It's not really uni because it also starts to split immediately as soon as you put on a field.
Okay.
So, you know, it becomes a very elongated rectangle. And then that rectangle sort of stretches out,
and
becomes
so
a square.
What are the two states?
It's not really a pneumatic, right? It's got fourfold symmetry.
That's right, yeah.
Calling it a pneumatic is not really
accurate. Yeah. It's got 90 degree rotation symmetry, that's
tranic,
right.
Pneumatic transition. So it breaks the.
I see, so that's the name of this guy.
That's a disordered state. The square is a disordered state, and I, now I.
That's right.
The degeneracy between the two ideas.
That's right, yeah.
It still has a phase.
No, it's disordered in the sense of relative.
And relative to this order parameter.
It's modulo 4, modulo pi over 2.
But it's more symmetrical state.
You should call it a tetradic, actually.
Okay. Yeah, we didn't...
Tell me what it is, because it's not really a biaxial pneumatic.
There's nothing like a square biaxial, right? It's always some sort of like a cigarette box. There are no square sides in the usual biaxial.
A pneumatic is it's just an ellipse with three different...
That's right.
I think it's square.
Yeah, I think one of the terminologies we've used is just the square state, which is,
it's
tetradic.
That's what they call it in the crystal.
It certainly has more symmetry. I think the real issue in this experimental prospects is the kind of timescales one is talking about. So if you have a picokelvin, that's of order, you know, a fraction of a second. Right, so use uncertainty principle to convert in time scale. So you'd really like to push this up by an order of magnitude at least so that you can, the condensate survives for a time scale that's longer than this energy scale so that it can influence the state of the system. Okay, and, so one of the things we're investigating is whether we can push it up in optical lattices where you can change the density. You can raise the density locally, and it's a very sensitive function of the density.
Does the mass enter in this thing?
Yeah.
The mass as well.
Yeah, so sodium 23 is better.
No, I'm talking about changing the effective mass in the optical lattice.
Ah, I see.
So it's a bigger effect at smaller mass.
That's right, yeah. So it's not.
The optical lattice will hurt that.
Yeah, but the dense.
Increase the mass.
But the local density is higher, right, in an optical lattice.
So. Which thing wins, yeah.
But the mass is
right. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not obvious a priori.
The mass issue might be the dominant.
Yeah, that's in some tight binding limit, right? If you're in sort of the weak, empty lattice limit, you just get a sort of density modulation that, you know. Yeah, but you know, it's a sensitive function of the density, right? N to the 3 by 2 or N to the 5 by 2. Okay, so that's the end of part one. I don't know if it's, I can stop here also. Oh, so it's about.
Mentioned it on your initial slide, right?
Yeah. So it's what happened. Okay, so let me just
Not dynamics.
It's about transitions in these when you have this sort of magnetic superfluidity. Right. So very briefly, let me just say it in two minutes. This is really looking at spin one condensates in this polar state. Okay, so you have a pneumatic vector and you have, superfluidity, right? And if you have an easy plane pneumatic, both of these are U1. So I'm actually thinking of some magnetic field selecting out a particular direction and forcing this pneumatic vector to be in the plane. Okay, so you have two U1s in this case. And if you're in two dimensions and at finite temperature, both of these have algebraic order. That's the polar superfluid. But the question is, how do you disorder the system? Right, we know vortices are responsible for disordering the system. And the interesting thing about this state is that actually the vortices of this are linked to the vortices of that. Okay, so we know that for a pneumatic, you have disclinations, right? Okay, so it turns out that in this case, actually, this is recognized by Faiso many years back. Disclinations in the spin 1 condensate actually carry a half vortex of superfluid vorticity with them. So the defects are tied to one another. Okay, so because of this tying up of the defects, it turns out it changes the universality class of this transition. So you can get the regular costless Thouless transition, but you can also get a different kind of transition where so there are different species of vortices in this case. Okay, there's this sort of vortex. You can call it a half-half vortex, but there are also regular superfluid vortices. So let me call it a unit vortex. Okay, so there's various different transitions, but I think the most interesting transition is a situation where at the transition point, this kind of this sort of defect is irrelevant. It's not unstable, but this guy is going unstable. Okay, so soon as it goes unstable, the superfluid stiffness in the charged sector drops to zero. That's usual KT transition. But in that process, it makes this irrelevant. So this is actually a dangerously irrelevant operator. So you can find a transition where there are two diverging length scales, a KT-like transition, where there are two diverging length scales triggered by this vortex, but while the superfluid stiffness is dropping, it triggers this to go unstable as well. So that's sort of the two-line summary of that transition. And it's something we believe that can be looked for in these systems. And presumably there are many more transitions in higher dimensions and so on where, and because of this entangling of defects, you get some new physics.
These are the types of vortices people are talking about for puzzles in quantum computing?
No.
It's not related to
that. There are no co-states in this. No co-states.
Half vortex is not.
Yeah, so actually this is quite easy to see. The reason this happens is that there's a Berry's phase effect. You take this pneumatic and you rotate it by 180 degrees, the two points in the sphere. Rotated by 180 degrees is like taking a spin half around by 180. Right? So that gets a Berry's phase of pi. In a condensate, you can't tolerate a Berry's phase like that. So disclination is not allowed by itself. It makes the condensate non-single valued along a line. So in order to rectify that, you trap a half superfluid vortex. So this doesn't occur for spin 2. I have a uniaxial spin 2 pneumatic, there's no Berry's phase, and you don't have this binding. But for the square state, this tetratic, is it? The tetratic state. You have a quarter vortex, you have a half vortex that's bound to this quarter thing. And for the cyclic state as well, there's a one-third vortex that's bound. You can rotate where the three legs of the tetrahedron go into each other. That defect is a one-third vortex attached.
Now, are the two U1 stiffnesses different parameters?
Okay, that's a good question. So in mean field theory, they're not.
They're
right.
They're set by the same constants.
They're set by the same constant, but the kinetic energy of the free gas. But if you have any kind of fluctuation, for example...
Equal stiffness?
Yeah, that's right.
So then the half-half is the lower energy vortex.
That's right, exactly.
And they will unbind.
They unbind. So that's sort of a not very interesting transition, right?
That's just a conventional.
It's conventional. A stiffness jump is something different, but basically KT. That's right, yeah. But if you allow these stiffnesses to be different, there's one obvious case where they'll be different when you have an optical lattice. So you can drive a by turning up the strength of the optical lattice. You can drive a transition between a polar superfluid, pneumatic order plus superfluid order, to pneumatic order and insulator, right, with one atom per site. And clearly there one is dropping, one is constant, so you can get any ratio you want. So for this interesting kind of transition, you need a factor of three difference between the two stiffnesses. Any one can be larger, but in symmetric, of course, but factor of three.
No lattice, S equals 1, and we are just discussing the phase diagram at tiny temperature, a function of some other parameters of the Hamiltonian. What's known about the phase diagram?
Okay, so one parameter you can tune is this magnetic field. So people have looked at the situation with zero magnetic field when this thing is O3 symmetric. Actually, Shubroto has looked at that. So in that case, because it's two dimensions, you can't have an O3 kind of order in your system, right? The only kind of partial orders you can.
Three dimensions where we have fluctuations and stuff.
Where you don't have that many fluctuations.
In 3D?
Yeah.
No fluctuations?
Except near the transition, right?
In
lower dimension, more fluctuations, right?
Yeah, but in 2D we have this special Gossler's lattice
picture. Okay,
Excluded. So in 3D, just my naive understanding is that we still have fluctuation of phase condition.
At the transition, yeah.
At the transition, and my question is, what's known about the phase?
I don't know, actually. The phases are kind of, say?
Should be first order.
Not, no. Well, which pneumatic transition? Maybe some, in this case, you're going to go from a...
In 3D with no magnetic field.
Yeah, there's no chi cube term here.
Can you generate a chi cube?
No, because chi is carries charge, right?
Ah, okay.
So that's...
We have two different orders, one magnetic order and a superfluid order. And the question number one, in my opinion, is just which one happens first as you go
yeah.
to lower and lower. Yeah, but at the same time, you can't have one without the other, can you?
Why? You can, why not?
Maybe you can talk about it. Yeah, it's. The question is what's realistic and what's possible, right? For example, Toner and company looked at these different ways in which a pneumatic can disorder, first order or through, an intermediate disordered, pneumatically disordered but topologically ordered phase, two continuous transitions. So you can think of analogs of that where you have superfluidity but not pneumatic order, but that's something, it's a more exotic scenario, right? But okay, we can. For me, yeah, I'm a simple man. But okay, I think it's probably maybe,
okay, so maybe
gone on.
You're saying.